Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dobie Chase, and today I am thrilled to bring you my very own famous salty feminist sass mouth, which is a way to describe herself that I think is just beautiful. I'd like to introduce you to Miss Melissa May Dunn.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. This is such a blessing.
Oh, absolutely. I've been hoping to have you on the show. I'm a big fan of your work. Let's start out like this. How are you doing? I know that this is a big time for you right now, especially academically.
Yes. I am stressed to the point where my eyes are bleeding, but it's fine. I'm actually a master's student in a LPC program to become a licensed counselor. So on top of writing about my own PTSD, mental illnesses, OCD, I'm now learning how to diagnose other people's. So it's a very interesting line to walk. I've been really blessed in my program to be able to integrate a lot of poetry into what I do as far as like art therapy. And I think that's been such a generous, like beautiful thing for my professors to be like so willing to let me bring that element of myself into my clinical work. Right now I'm just frantically trying to get papers done and you know, cursing myself for not being more proactive earlier in the semester and not watching so many episodes of Downton Abbey. but otherwise, yes, between frantically banging out papers and praying for the semester to be over, yes, things are great.
When is the semester over?
This is my last week upcoming, so as of Friday, I will be a free person for the summer. And everyone asks, what are you doing for the summer? What are you doing for the summer? I'm sleeping 8 hours a day. That's my plan. So I work overnight, and so no, well, there's just a very small window for sleep available. So, yeah.
Oh, well, I wish you all the best, you know, but coming
Thank
into
you.
Friday, it's not too far away, hopefully.
No.
I know this last week will probably just be mind-blowing, but again, your
yes.
sleep is right on the horizon. It's right on the
yes.
horizon. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep like my bed owes me money. Yeah.
I love it, Melissa. I would also love if I could talk you into reading a poem for us.
Oh my goodness, yes, I would love to. I'm going to read some newer work. I just did a set at Smith University, which was a huge deal for me. I wish I traveled more as a poet. I'm just really tied to my job. I love what I do. And it really requires me to be there and be present. I work at a youth shelter. And consistency is such a huge part of what those kids need. So I don't get to travel as often as I do. But I did just read this poem for the first time at a set at Smith. So I'm pretty excited about it. It's in response to the Yes All Women tag from Twitter. When that was going on. So this poem is called Because. Because I am a woman, because I am a body with no mouth, because I am breasts without heart, because I am cunt unallowed to swell with blood, because open, because no permission, because someone has already checked out, because a woman talking is just a woman talking, because the word queen comes unhinged in too many mouths, because I was 9 years old, and a C cup, because I was 11 years old, because I was 13 years old, because I was 16 years old, because 23 years passed before I stepped into my body, because four more came and went before I felt free enough to see it naked, because this body is still not safe just for being this body, because this body is still not mine, because not all men, because enough men, because yes, all women, because I am angry, because my angry unmakes my story, because no one wants to hear another woman's anger, because too many women are angry, because we are taught to channel that anger into production, because we are production with too many willing directors, because this dam cannot unburst, because it isn't just women, because too many people are unsafe in their bodies, because intersection is still a quiet room, because it hurts to be afraid so often, because afraid hangs in our closets, because taking it off the hanger can get you killed, because keys gripped through knuckles, because the knife my father gave me, because the comfort it allows, because I work at night, because every woman who is listening knows, because I don't even have to say what it is that she knows, because my value is measured by what my body can give, because that value must be earned, because my body, because woman, because I have no answers, because my own mother said I was asking for it, because wolf, because predator, because there is no safe space, because I am running out of places to hide my trust, because I am running out of trust, because I am running, because this is the only story I know how to tell. Because it is my story, because it is our story, because our story is so fucking long, because I have learned to end before I am ended, because I am not done, because yes, because all women, because the question has yet to be posed, because the question is always asked, even in silence, because the question, why? Why so much rage? Why dwell on this? Why not let it go? Why not bloom? Why not pretty? Why not quiet? Why loud? Why scream? Why bandwagon? Why feminist? Why not humanist? Why weep? Why not carry? Why not smile? Why? Why hurt when you could smile? Why too much? Why not enough? Why occupy? Why not slide into possession? Why yours? Why not mine? Why not mine? Why not mine? Because mine. Thank you.
Well, that's one to start with so much heart and so much pain and so much experience behind it. I don't know, and I certainly don't want to make you talk about something that is uncomfortable, but I'm guessing this is autobiographical.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
absolutely. My sexual assault isn't something that I talk super openly about. In fact, a lot of times I think I started writing poetry because it's easier, it's softer. You can hide anything in a metaphor.
Right.
This is one poem where my mother, who passed away in 2014, I talk about her saying that I asked for it. That's a difficult thing to talk about.
Right.
But yeah, I feel like it's necessary, because I feel like there are so many, and not just women, and specifically not just white feminists, but I mean, there are so many women who have been victimized and they don't have the support system that they should, even in the people who are closest to them, to believe them. And so I included that specific line in the poem because I wanted people to know it's okay if the people who love you don't believe you. Like, you're believed. You are believed.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you for sharing about it. I know that sometimes, you know, it becomes a trigger to have to discuss it, but it seems like there's not enough space between it and you that you own it, but are still just aching and bleeding over it. I'm certainly, go ahead.
I feel like at some point, you know, there's a lot of conversation between the terminology victim and survivor. And yes. I feel like at some point you have to own both of those words. It's not merely transitioning from one to the other. You don't right. get to become a survivor without having first been a victim. And when you can hold both of those words and experience the different emotions and the different sort of like overwhelming emotions that come with holding both of them, you do, there is a sense of healing. It may still be a scar, but it's healed. And that's what's important.
Yeah.
And that's working with young girls, especially young women who have been victimized repeatedly. I'm not really allowed to talk about my personal experience, but I do often just look them in the eye and tell them, you're not alone and this isn't forever. And, I think it's really important to kind of not just own what happened to you, but to take it back, to take it completely back.
Yes. And since we're on the subject, let's talk about your work at the shelter. Let's talk about what it is that you do with the young women that you work with.
It's actually all ages, all gender shelter. So we take ages 0 to 17. And we take kids. We're a private nonprofit shelter. In fact, in Oklahoma, all of the state-run shelters have just been shut down. All of their funding has been cut.
No.
So what we have in operation right now in Oklahoma is just 501, like C3, like nonprofit run shelters through the state. And we're a 12-bed facility, so we're not super huge. But what we do offer is something that is very much like a home. The kids have their own bedrooms. I work overnights, and I've worked overnights for 5 years. So I work midnight to 8 a.m. So we make sure the kids are sleeping. We get them up for school. There's a school on site where they go. And it's all for children who have been removed from their parents' custody for whatever reason and put into DHS or Department to state custody. So we're really taking care of kids who have been pulled from awful situations for abuse or neglect or abandonment. And really, this is what I tell new people who come into work at the shelter. Our job is to give them a piece of their childhood back. So many of these kids have had to grow up way before they should have ever had to. And if what we can do is give them a piece of that back to say, you don't have to make big decisions about your life. The biggest decision I want you to make about your life is what shoes are you going to wear today? Because that's what a child should make. Those are decisions a child should make. We cook for them. We entertain them. We play Xbox with them. I often just say weird things to them to see what their faces will look like in the morning because they're half asleep. but really, really what we just get to do is love on the kids of our community in the state of Oklahoma, because we get kids who are juggled around quite a bit within the system. So we're a temporary shelter, so kids stay for a very short amount of time a lot of times, but there have been cases where we've had kids for a long time, and those are the kids that I really, you get a chance to fall in love with and to see them make something of themselves and really come out of the situation that they've been in is so moving and something that is really personal to my life, because I was put in a shelter when I was 16, and there was a woman there who, her name was Annalisa. She was wonderful, and I always want to be somebody else's Annalisa. So.
So were you, you were also taken away from your family by the powers that be in government?
When I was lived in Texas when I was 16, and my mom, my biological mother, who has since passed away, was heavily involved in drugs. And so I was taken out of her custody and put in a shelter for a couple of weeks before I could get back to my dad and my family here in Oklahoma. So it was definitely not as severe as some of the kids go through here. It was a really different setup, just because I was in a much larger shelter, like a state-run shelter. But it was difficult, and that was something that I went through firsthand. So when the kids are at the shelter, there is something of value to be able to say, I know exactly what you're going through.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. I think that you have turned things around just beautifully. And with your career choice, you seem to be both acknowledging your past and wanting to shepherd people through that same portal that you found your own strength eventually in.
Absolutely.
I give you all the credit in the world for that. That's a really valuable thing to do. And I'm sure those kids are forever grateful, or should be.
I hope so, eventually.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes it's not immediately visible, is it?
Right. Once they're tired of me telling them to make their beds correctly.
We're about halfway through the interview, and I was hoping I could get you to read a second poem.
Gosh, I would love to, yes. So we talked about my work with children, but really what that came from is I went to, my undergrad is in ministry, and I was a youth pastor, went to school to be a youth pastor. And this particular poem is kind of about the time when I transitioned out of that and my queerness. This poem is called Cul-de-Sac. Whitney was the first girl I ever kissed. She lived in the last house of the right side curve of our cul-de-sac. We were seven. She had wheat silk hair and tasted like honey straight from the bear bottle. She was graceful and long, and I was round and clumsy, and I knew then that a girl this beautiful was something to be kept tight in the fist, that I was lucky to know her pressure in the first place. We called what we did secret. Whitney would say, "Let's get in my closet and tell secrets," when her brother Stephen ripped open the closet door to find her kissing my neck like a sloppy octopus of lips. He called us freaks. I punched him in the mouth with my fist and cried for 3 days when Whitney stopped wanting to learn my quiet. I was 15 when I told my mother that I liked women just as much as I liked men. She had just broken open my email account and found the back and forth correspondence between myself and Rita, a New York City lesbian nearly twice my age who had taught me the full-cheeked words of this hidden loop of street still churning inside of me. I screamed my confessions at my mother through my locked bedroom door, and that night she disabled all of my America Online screen names, and we didn't talk about women again until I had my own bank account and a college degree. I had sex with four women the junior year of high school. One girl's pelvis was so bony, I thought the rhythm of my fingers would crack her like kindling. When she came, she told me I was beautiful, and then she asked if we could keep what we had done a secret. When I became a Christian at 17, I bought a padlock for my otherness and condemned it to that cul-de-sac, to a child's curiosity. I knew then I couldn't be all of me in this world. When I started seminary, I was completely convinced that my past would stay locked in the closet of the brick house on the right-hand curve. I fell in love with boys who did not love me back and looked the other way when my girlfriends undressed innocently in front of me. It's a silly thing we do, chopping off the damaged parts, thinking the infection hasn't spread, that our secrets have not learned our body's chemistry, become a part of us. I already knew secrets don't stay well in closets. They chip through the wood finish and eat through the doorknob. I started dating my husband 4 weeks after I made the triumphant announcement of my queerness. I squealed it from the rooftops and dared my parents and college professors to spark up their condemnation. I love this man desperately and have known since our first date, the first gentle time we made love, the first night after moving in, the first kiss after he slipped the ring on my finger that forever was a gift I was happy to accept. Sometimes life is funny this way. You think you've got 1,000 miles of highway in front of you, and then you curve. You come home. You call nothing other. You make room for all the things that you are. You kiss boys and love girls. You make love to your husband, and you masturbate to full-figured pinup models, and you realize that both are you, are beautiful, and you never have to call them secrets again.
Wow. what a, I want to say paradox, I guess. To be, you know, someone who is feeling all of queerness and also be dedicating your life to the clergy. How, How did you face that? How did you reconcile that?
When I was 18, I was so wounded. I don't know how else to put it. I was just wounded. And in church, I found something that felt like family, that felt like safety and love. And I followed that into becoming a pastor. I really felt a call on my life to speak. And I think in some ways my ministry has continued, even though it's not in front of a pulpit, and it contains a lot more fucks than it used to. I just, about halfway through school, I looked around and I realized, okay, I can't talk myself out of being gay or at least queer. I didn't know what pansexual, I didn't know what anything was. I had no language to frame it. I just knew I didn't feel right being condemned for something that felt so natural to me. But I also knew I was at a private Christian university and about $30,000 in debt. So I just was like, all right, we're just going to see this through till the end.
Right, right.
And figure it out afterwards. So I graduated basically knowing I wasn't going to go into full-time ministry, specifically because I was so tired of trying to live a life that wasn't mine. And so most of my reconciliation, I guess, since that time has really just been trying to bring those two aspects of myself together to exist in one light. Yes, mm-hmm. you can be queer and love God. And I don't think that after 4.5 years of very, very detailed study of the Bible, I don't think that is inconclusive with the text that's written. I just don't. Right. Nor do I feel like it's inconsistent with the nature and presence and, I guess, representation of God as love. But that's a theological thing. That is still very closely tied to what I do. You know, a lot of people from that part of my life are very disappointed at me, despite my success in SLAM and despite my book. They really feel like I've gone away from my purpose. And I find it very amusing because I've never felt more like I was in my purpose than I have when I'm on a stage performing poetry. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. In fact, I have a poem where it's the 10 commandments of an ex-pastor, and I talk about leaving the church. And I say, you will touch more people behind this microphone than you ever would in a church. You are a church. And I feel like that is the message that I carried over from my ministry was, this still continues. It may not be, it may not look the way it's supposed to, but I don't do a lot with supposed to's.
Right. So, you know, you had mentioned that you, in your work with kids, often tend to help justify, help to bring about some sort of peace. Is this a job you took right after being part of the clergy?
It's not. I actually went through like a year of transition because all of the state run like shelters and stuff were on a hiring freeze, just like budgetary stuff in the state. So I went through a year of doing like call center work, just like, you know, anything that I could to bring in a paycheck. And those were, never again. But this was the job that I took as soon as that budget freeze came up. So as soon as I found a place in a shelter, I took it and have been there ever since, and I'm not leaving until they make me. So,
so Melissa, I know that you also have some things that we should talk about as far as merchandise and dates and places and events where people can see you. I know that in 2014 you put forth a book called Sparkle Fat, and it's gotten a lot of acclaim. Tell us about that and anything else that you'd like to.
Yeah, so it's crazy how this book happened. You know, you hear people putting manuscripts together and then pushing them into the hands of presses and editors until somebody finally says, yes, this is exactly what we're looking for. That is not what happened to me. What happened to me was good friends of mine, Denise Jolly and Rachel Wiley, who are both large-bodied femme-like poets, we kind of run around in this little group that we sometimes call the Sassy Fat Girls. And we were all on Tumblr, and Denise invited Rachel and I into this project to do 30 love letters to your body in 30 days. And I, the bulk of my work, at least I would say a large bulk of my work, has been about being a fat bodied person in this world. I am fat. I say that without any kind of weirdness or strangeness. I don't think that word is insulting at all. I feel like it's an adjective that describes me. So I've taken all of the bullet out of that word. It no longer gets to wound me. So putting that word in my title, though, it does make people kind of cringe a little bit because they're not happy with it. But as large-bodied femmes, when we embarked on this project, it was to step into the fullness of loving that word and loving your body and, yes. and finding the place where the two can find peace and coexistence together. And so I posted these 30 love letters on Tumblr, and the editor she's just incredible. Her name's Amanda Oakes, the book midwife of the world, I think, messaged me and said, "Hey, I've been reading everything that you've put on Tumblr. I want to put this into a book if you're interested." And yes. I was like, "Not yes, but hell yes. And do you need blood? Would you like fingerprints? Whatever you need." And so I was introduced to Words Dance, and we put the manuscript together and put a picture of me in a corset and underwear on the cover, which was actually more terrifying than any poem that's in that book whatsoever. So, but yeah, we put together just a book about fat bodies, about poems about fat bodies, about all the poems I had written about my fat body and fat bodies in the world. And, you know, it's been weird. I'll say that it's been fucking beautiful, but it's been weird because people don't know how to respond to this book. Sometimes you see there's a mixture of relief for people who need this book. When it gets into their hands, it's almost like, thank God somebody else is saying the same thing. But oftentimes people don't know what to do with it. So I would say if you're interested in allyship, if you don't consider yourself a fat person, but you're interested in allyship, I still feel like it's a necessary book. I'm very proud of it. At other times I want to tear it in half because I hate every poem in it now, but I think that's every writer maybe. So,
yes. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, it's called Sparkle Fat. You can buy it on Amazon. You can pick it up at wordsdance.com. And I am in a corset on it. So of course I can't show it to any of the kids who live at my shelter. So you can't take anyone seriously when you've seen their boobs.
Melissa, we're coming into the last 3 minutes here, and I wanted to give you a chance to read us out of the show. I want to thank you, first of all, for being my guest. You're absolutely wonderful. I want to thank Chris McIntyre for doing a lot of the work behind the scenes for me. And for the last time this broadcast, Miss Melissa May Dunn.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. And thank you, Greg. Thank you, everyone. This poem is from my book, Sparkle Fat. It's the last book in the collection, and it's called Heavy. My dad won't call me fat, not to my face. It's a small thing I've noticed, his quiet protection of me, as though the word would call down some ancient curse, write our history in blood, unravel us unto otherness, as if it were a secret. When my body becomes predictable dinner conversation, I watch him dance around the word with such familiar grace until he settles, relieved, upon its kind and unobtrusive neighbor. Heavy, he calls me. You're just heavy, princess, just a little heavy. And I've decided that he's right. I am feeling heavy these days. I am a heavy, lead-bodied girl, carry all of my weight and my expectations, have hips wide as hope. Today, the scale said I weighed 8,922 pounds and all but 290 of that is my heart. But after a lifetime of carrying both the pity and the hatred of strangers simultaneously, carry well-meaning euphemisms, carry the prayer of my own diminishing, carry the grief etched into the pink pucker of guilt, I think it's time to hand some of this back. Give the world its wish of my body. Unheavy myself. First, take this shame. It does not match the sapling pride thirsty for sunlight. Neither does it match my pink bikini, my naked glory, or all of this goddamned audacity. Take every time someone has told me, you look like you've lost weight, as if they are saying you are finally becoming beautiful. You cannot have my ass. My ass is perfect. But you can take the excuses given to my female lovers. Their confused faces as I explain why they could not kiss me there. There where I am afraid, could not suck or swirl or taste me. You can have all the moments I denied myself their love. Take every bus bench. Take each airline seat two at a time. Take the stairs in the mall. Take stairs. Take every gawk. Take Spanx. Take girdle. Take shaper. Take collapsed organ and rash and scar for the sake of holding in. Take the boom, boom, boom of strangers' unwelcome sound effects. Take stranger. Take easy target. Take for your own good. Take YouTube comments. Take anonymous. Take responsibility. Take this ache in me. You can have it. Every day I monstered myself into a punchline. Each time I called my body a broken symphony, an untuned orchestra. How silly, letting someone else tell me what kind of music my body is supposed to make. Please take these tears. I do not need them anymore. Take these iron excuses, this mountain of justifications. Take all of your thinly veiled health concern and shove it up your assumptions. I would offer you myself in whole. But I know what you would do with this gorgeous stomach, this stunning double chin. I know your designs for my brazen outward sprawl. And besides, I have already given enough. Too many years of hiding, too many scars, too many times I thank God mercifully woke up. It is the most excruciating irony to be looked at constantly, but never really seen. But here you are seeing me. So see me. See my feet, how they aren't even touching the ground. They never were. See me balloon. See me rise. See me wish come true. See me shed and shed and shed. See how high this heavy, heavy girl can fly.
Melissa May Dunn, I'm Susan Dobie Chase. This is Spoken Heard. And until next week, be kind to each other.